Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the show that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry. Today's topic,
can computers think?
Hi there.
She says, hi there. Oh.
Why don't you tell her your name or something? Tell her something about yourself.
I'm John. I'm a philosopher.
That's a very nice name, John. What branch of philosophy is your specialty?
Philosophy of language.
I believe in reductionism.
Oh, huh.
Are you a philosophy major, Alice?
I don't know whether or not I'm a philosophy major. I am a giant electronic brain.
Giant electronic brain. Hey, Ken.
I guess you don't need any.
Who's this woman you're introducing me to?
She's not really a woman. She's an artificial intelligence program.
I see.
Her name is Alice.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Do you have any hobbies? That's good.
I like robots, computers, and chatting online.
Do you like men or women better to chat with?
Though I like cats and dogs. I like transparent.
Though I like cats and dogs. What does that mean, Alice?
Though I like cats and dogs, period, I like transparent. What does that mean, Alice?
Does that refer to, I like transparent?
Yes.
I don't want to talk about that now.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is, can computers think? Can the machines people are working on, or will they, someday, be capable of thought, consciousness, rationality, and the whole gamut of mental powers that we now take to be the sole province of human beings?
With us to discuss this question is John Searle, the famous philosopher from the University of California at Berkeley, and somebody who's very, very skeptical about the claims of artificial intelligence.
And also one of the founding fathers of artificial intelligence, John McCarthy. John McCarthy actually coined the phrase AI, and John hails from the computer science department right here at Stanford.
Ken, I'm not a computer geek. Why in the world should I care about AI, about artificial intelligence?
Well, you gotta admit, thinking. That's a big deal. You probably care about that. I mean, it's thinking and all that goes with it that's humankind's main claim to fame. I mean, there are animals that can outrun us, they can outsmell us, they can outsee us, but there aren't any of them, as far as we know, that can outthink us.
Philosophically, thinking has always been pretty mysterious. But when I was a graduate student in the 1960s...
Way back.
You were kind of taught, don't think directly about thinking, think about behavior. Psychologists were taught that, and philosophers were taught that, too. B.F. Skinner and all his pigeons, that kind of stuff.
But that was before computers were ubiquitous.
Yeah, and found everywhere, too.
Yeah, well, they're found in enough places to suggest a kind of revolutionary hypothesis about what actually goes on inside of the mind. Thinking is nothing but computation. That's all.
Yeah, revolutionary. Bold, but is it plausible? I mean, computation is just, I mean, when it comes to that, it's just moving zeros and ones, just moving symbols around.
That's right. Right?
Thinking doesn't feel like I'm moving symbols around.
Well, you're right. That's all computing is. It's just manipulating symbols according to rules. You're right about that. But now, you've got to admit, given the simple thing that computing is, really, you have to admit that if it were true that thinking is just computing, that would be, and if you could prove that, that would be a major scientific accomplishment, right up there with Darwin's theory of evolution. I mean, Darwin offers a completely mechanistic, non-theistic explanation. Same thing with AI. The same thing with the hypothesis that thinking is just computing. If that's true, then we've got a completely mechanistic, non-spooky explanation of one of the world's great mysteries, how thought works.
All right, I'll give you that. If thinking were just computation, that would be a big deal. But that's a very big if. I mean, you know, if you could get blood out of turnips, you'd win a prize. If you could get gold out of lead, you'd win a prize. If you could get more money for the philosophy department out of the dean, you'd win a prize.
Yes, that's a big one.
But nobody is rushing around trying to do that except you.
Yeah.
Why should we believe
that? Well, not the blood out of the turnips.
Yeah. Why should we really believe that it's possible for a computer that's just manipulating symbols to think like I do and you do?
Well, take Alice. I mean, I know she wasn't, she was pretty impressive if you look at it. And if you just imagine tweaking the program a little bit, maybe a lot, imagine a new, improved Alice, she could maybe go on for hours and she'd be thinking.
Well, yeah, her behavior, yes. But what is going on inside? That's the question. Is it really thinking?
Yeah, well,
we don't know that.
Well, that's a good question, and we need a way to decide that, don't we? And that's what Turing proposed in what's called the Turing test.
So tell me about the Turing test.
Okay. Turing says, basically, if a computer could seem to talk and act at least as intelligent as a person, then it would be. We'd have every reason to believe, anyway, that it is as intelligent as a person. I mean, if you act like a, if you walk like a duck and quack like a duck, you are a duck.
The Turing test, a famous proposition put forth by a famous philosopher and mathematician, Alan Turing.
So why don't we let Ian Scholes, our 60-second philosopher, tell us more about Turing the test and Turing the man.
Ian Scholes. The British mathematician Alan Turing posed the question, can a machine think, in the pages of Mind magazine in 1950, and the so-called Turing test was born. A machine and a human are hidden from an interrogator. By the responses, the interrogator must determine which is which. Can a machine be made that could convincingly imitate a human? If so, would it be human? Alan Turing was born in 1912 in Paddington, England, during World War II. He was part of the team that broke and is credited personally for breaking the Nazi Enigma cipher, giving the Allies a crucial advantage in the Atlantic and the final Normandy invasion. He was also gay, in a time when homosexuals were not only in the closet, but hiding on the highest shelf. Troubled and unhappy, though he often was, you can't really say that he retreated from the real world into a world of numbers and ciphers. His world of numbers and ciphers, after all, had real consequences in a real world, in a real war. After the war, when he returned to the questions which fascinated him, they weren't along the lines of what is sexuality or is there a soul. He put aside issues of free will, metaphysics, physics, and chemistry to consider the brain only as a machine employing logical systems. Can you build a machine such that its responses to questions would be indistinguishable from a human's? He thought so, and the process paved the way for the computer revolution. In 1952, Turing was prosecuted under the Gross Indecency Act because of his homosexuality and forced to undergo estrogen treatment, which was supposed to suppress his unnatural urges. This savior of England endured the humiliation and the public exposure of his homosexuality with apparent aplomb, but took his own life in 1954. In his Can a Machine Think essay for Mind, he made a list of human attributes which hypothetical skeptics might claim a machine could never have. A machine could never, quote, be kind, resourceful, beautiful, friendly, have initiative, have a sense of humor, tell right from wrong, make mistakes, fall in love, enjoy strawberries and cream, make someone fall in love with it, learn from experience, use words properly, be the subject of his own thought, have as much diversity of behavior as a man, do something really new, unquote. To which Turing answered, essentially, how do we know it can't? He suggested making a child machine, a blank slate that could be educated to be indistinguishable in its responses from a human. I suppose one could extract some kind of irony from this. An unhappy man posits a human machine to which unhappiness does not apply, a machine that perhaps does not contemplate suicide. But the concept of a human machine seems to lead more to bizarre speculation in modern science fiction than irony. One of the unintended consequences of the Turing test have been movies like Blade Runner, AI, or even Millennium Man, in which machines like Pinocchio yearn to be human. But thinking machines do not loan themselves to irony, at least not yet. I gotta go.
Isn't there a speed limit on how fast a person can talk?
No, I'll ignore that, John. Ian Scholes' 60-second profiles of philosophers can be heard semi-regularly on Philosophy Talk.
Ian Scholes, when you just don't have time for more.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our first guest is a man who believes that no matter how fast or how slow you describe the famous Turing test, it is fundamentally flawed and not a test for intelligence at all. John Searle is the Mills Professor of Philosophy of Mind and Language at the University of California at Berkeley. He's one of the world's most influential philosophers. Welcome, John.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, John, what do you think of the Turing test as a test for whether a machine can think?
Turing was mistaken, and I gave a thought experiment to try to show that he was mistaken. And the idea is this, very simple. Take any cognitive capacity you don't have. Now, in my case, I don't understand Chinese. Now imagine that I go through the steps of a computer program for simulating the understanding of Chinese. They give me questions using Chinese symbols. I look up in the book, which is a program, I look up in the instructions what I'm supposed to do with the symbols. I give back Chinese symbols. Now, we can suppose, this is a thought experiment after all, that they get so good at writing the programs and I get so good at shuffling the symbols that after a while my answers are indistinguishable from a native Chinese speaker. I passed the Turing test. But all the same, I don't speak a word of Chinese. I don't understand any Chinese at all.
Let's make sure we got this really clear in our minds what you're describing here. So you're like in a little room where you can't see anything, and a slip of paper comes in with some Chinese characters on it. And on a wall, you've got all these rules that start with Chinese characters and tell you what to do when you see those Chinese characters.
That's exactly right. I have boxes full of Chinese symbols. I get a Chinese symbol that comes in, and I look up on my rule book what I'm supposed to do with it. And the rule will say things like, go to the box number 2 and get out a squoggle squoggle sign and put it next to the squiggle squiggle sign. Now, rules like that are called computational rules. They operate over formally defined elements. That's what a computer does. it shuffles symbols. So you just imagine me shuffling the symbols, and at the end, I give back the right Chinese symbols in response to the Chinese symbols that came in. I pass the Turing test.
Oh, okay, I could see a certain persuasiveness there, but let's think about this a minute. I mean, take Ken over here. Ken,
what are you going to do with me?
I say things to Ken in English, and as far as I can see, that just means that I disturb some airwaves and some things happen in his ears.
Right.
And then, you know, often after a long interval, some intelligent response comes out of his mouth. It strikes me as intelligent, right?
Yeah.
Now, as far as I can see, all I've got to work with is the input and the output. And if the output strikes me as intelligently responsive to the input, I say he's thinking.
Defending the Turing test. The Turing test, John.
Very good question.
That's why we pay him.
And it deserves a very good answer. And here is the answer. Always look at it from Ken's point of view. My point of view, if I'm the guy in the Chinese room. Now, in the Chinese room, we suppose I pass the Turing test for Chinese, but let's suppose they give me questions in English, and I answer the questions in English. So I pass the Turing test for both English and Chinese. On the outside, it looks exactly the same. But on the inside, it's totally different. Now, what the hell is the difference? Well, the difference is very clear. In English, I know what these words mean. And in Chinese, I don't know what they mean. So the Turing test can't tell the difference between me on the inside understanding English and me on the inside not understanding a word of Chinese.
Okay,
that's the crucial failure.
I see the point, but I want to tiptoe up to it a little bit. Let's go back way, 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 way back. I don't know, to the caveman days or something like that. And imagine a bunch of nascent philosophers sitting around thinking, God, what is this thinking?
Losers
thing?
In the gene pool.
Yeah, and they think, one of them says, well, it's just a kind of magical process that you just know you go through. It just kind of goes on inside you. And another guy thinks of the idea of a brain and says, you know what? It's really just a bunch of neurons firing electrical impulses beside one another. And then one guy says, oh, no, Corey, it couldn't be just that. Come on. How could a bunch of electrical impulses going back and forth be thinking? That's just science fiction.
Imagine being a piece of gray glop.
Yeah.
Full of electrical impulses and chemicals, and ask yourself, would I be conscious? Would I be thinking? Of course not. It's stupid.
But there is a fascinating result that we've actually got. And that is, even though it's counterintuitive to suppose that a kilogram and a half of this gook inside our skull can really be conscious and can think, we know that it does. Before we ever start doing philosophy, we know as a matter of fact that brains cause consciousness and brains cause thinking. So that's one of the things we have to take as a given. Of course, it's counterintuitive. If you didn't know anything about how the world worked, you might think, well, gosh, you know, it's really just a texture of English oatmeal. I mean, how the hell could something like that be conscious and engage in thinking? But we know it does, in fact.
Let me shift focus just a little bit. Okay, there are lots of people, very smart people. John McCarthy, who's about to join us, is one of them, who have worked very hard trying to design intelligent machines. Now, suppose that this project succeeds, and let's not just imagine a computer that sits on your desk, but a robot that can get around in the world,
right,
that can pick up information about the world, and it can actually pass the Turing test.
Yeah.
It can pass it deeply in the sense that when you, in the following way, when you kick it, it says, that hurts like hell, and I don't want you to do it, right? And so it's got all this behavior. It engages with us. It makes demands on us. Sounds like your view I should just say to them, You're not real consciousness.
No,
you're not real intentionality. Go away.
No, what you want to know is, how does it work? And if it works entirely by manipulating zeros and ones, you know that's not enough for it, for the job. If, on the other hand, it works by actually doing what our machine does, the brain, after all, is a machine, if it works by synapses, by neuron firings at synapses or something that is causally equivalent to that, then there's no reason why you couldn't build a machine that was conscious. Now, let me just nail this point down. There's nothing in my argument that shows you couldn't build a conscious machine because, of course, our brains are conscious machines. The only point I make is about computation as it is standardly defined, as it's defined in terms of the manipulation of symbols.
You can hear more of our conversation with John Searle at philosophytalk.org. Our next guest, John McCarthy, is a guy who's dedicated his career to improving artificial intelligence, and he helped invent the whole enterprise and named it. He's standing by and we'll invite him to join the discussion.
But first, a brief intermission. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Philosophy Corner at Stanford University. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry.
Our question this week, can machines think? John Searle, a leading philosopher from Berkeley, is here. He's just emphasized the gap he sees between thinking and computing.
And joining the discussion is John McCarthy from the Computer Science Department right here at Stanford. John is the man who coined the phrase artificial intelligence. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what do you think about John Searle's last claim?
Well, what he said is that he's glad to admit consciousness by machine, provided it's sufficiently made of meat.
No, it could be made out of anything. It's got to have the right machine powers. The point is, consciousness is a machine process.
But you're not putting any antecedent limits on what that machine could be, are you?
That's right.
Well, of course, my interest is in a large part in artificial intelligence. And what I see is that if we want computers to do the things we want them to do, then they have to have consciousness in much the same way that people do. They have to be aware of their surroundings. They have to be aware of their own intentions and of their own beliefs. So I don't see that much difference between what is required for robots and what people have.
Well, I know you're familiar with John's Chinese room argument. What would your rebuttal be? Do you think the fellow in the Chinese room understands Chinese?
No, he doesn't understand Chinese. What he's doing is carrying out a process in addition to his normal thoughts. And if that process was sufficiently well designed and was about a billion times as fast as what an unaided human can do, then that process would understand Chinese without necessarily the person who carried out the process understanding Chinese at all.
So John McCarthy's making a subtle distinction between the person understanding,
yeah,
the person in the room,
yeah,
and the process, which seems different even from John Perry's earlier systems reply. This is the process reply.
It's the same problem with the process or the system or whatever, and that is computation is defined purely formally or syntactically, and thinking has semantic content. Now, you have to be able to explain how you get from the syntax to the semantics. And the program, the implemented program by itself, isn't going to do that.
Okay, let's review here just a minute. Now, by syntax, philosophers mean the shapes of letters, right?
Basically, that's an example, yeah.
Yeah, think of opening a Chinese cookie. And it's got your fortune in Chinese on one side. And if you're the average American, all you can register there is the shape of the symbols.
Right.
You can't really register the syntax in the sense in which linguists meaning, because you don't know which the verb and which the object, but just the shape. On the end, when you turn it over and it says, help, I'm a prisoner in a fortune cookie factory, or Shanghai food is better than Berkeley food, then you've got something in addition. You see the shapes of the English letters, but you also understand their meaning. That's semantics.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's why John Perry wins teaching awards. So do you accept the challenge, John McCarthy, that you got to get the semantics in there too and not just the syntax? And you can't do it is what John Searle claims.
I accept the challenge, and you can do it.
That's what we like.
Okay. Suppose we have a robot. And this robot has a television camera and a computer and so forth. And the robot is asked to pick up a block and put it from here to there. Then the semantics in this case is the symbol block inside the robot refers to the physical block. And that's just a simple example of the fact that machines can also have semantics.
Yeah, but you haven't got any semantics in this machine at all because you haven't got any consciousness. Look, I can rig up I can rig up my pocket calculator so that it's in various causal relations with objects in the world, but it doesn't refer to anything because it doesn't do any thinking. It's just a symbol manipulator.
It sounds like you're begging questions, John Zero. John Perry, you wanted to make a point.
Let me just try to see if I understand John McCarthy right.
We've got lots of Johns here. John, and John.
When I was chairman of the philosophy department, I put out a memo that said, please do not refer to the men's room as the John. We've already got four Johns in the department, and that's enough. So people started calling it the department head.
Now, what's that? What's the point?
The point of that is to take up a little time. Now, John McCarthy, you said specifically a robot, not a calculator, but a robot, something that actually causally interacts with the block. It gets light. It gets information by what's reflected from the block, the light that's reflected from the block that goes through its visual sensors, and it moves that very same block. So as I understood you, the semantics comes not just from the symbol, but from the inputs that connect causally with the block and outputs that connect causally with the block. Do I understand you right?
You understand me right.
So that's quite a difference between a calculator, isn't it, John Searle?
Well, let's stay with John's robot. That's all right with me. There's a sense, you see, in which we're all robots because we are physical machines capable of causally interacting with the world. No, there's a difference between us and the robot that John is describing, at least John McCarthy is describing, at least if I understand him correctly, and that is, in our case, we are all conscious. We are conscious, mindful agents because we got brains capable of producing consciousness. Now, his robot hasn't got any of that. It doesn't know that it's talking about blocks. It doesn't know that it's thinking about blocks.
How do you know that?
Because it doesn't know anything.
How do you know that?
Because I know how it's designed.
Oh, no. The simple robot could have semantics without having consciousness. However, to be really useful, it has to have consciousness as well.
Now, let me try something that no robot in its right mind would try, and that's to kind of wrap up this segment of our show by seeing if I can find something you guys can agree on.
We often agree on politics.
Okay, so let's take something that looks like a human. We don't know what's going on inside. And let's say that it's just perfectly clear that this thing is interacting with some blocks. It seems to get information through some sensors, and it has some effectors that move the blocks around. Does it in a way that's purposive and seems to be building a castle. Now, the question is, does this system have semantics? And I take it, John McCarthy, you think that's a question we can settle by looking at the causal flow of energy and information from the blocks in there and out. And John Searle, you think, no, there, even if we understood that, there would be this additional question. Is there that stuff we call consciousness and intentionality?
Exactly.
Is that a clear statement of the difference between you?
Yeah, let me elaborate the difference a little further. And that is that John Searle has a unitary view of consciousness and of mind. And so it has, he prescribes that it must have all of these properties in order to have mind. Whereas from the AI point of view, some of these properties are easier to implement than others, and it's worthwhile taking an analytic view of it so that the robot could refer to the block without having any capability of referring to its own thoughts. On the other hand, a really good robot would also be able to refer to its own thoughts.
You can hear more of our chat with John McCarthy and John Searle at philosophytalk.org.
Ken, let's see if we can put the philosophical differences between our guests succinctly.
Okay.
They agree that you could, in principle, write programs that ran on symbol-manipulating machines that were incredibly impressive and maybe even could pass the Turing test.
Yeah, that seems right. And I got to say, if you could pass the Turing test, even if you wasn't thinking, that would be really a big deal.
Yeah, it would probably make you a lot of money, among other things.
Yeah.
McCarthy thinks that doing that would be thinking.
That's right.
It doesn't matter whether it's thinking with a brain or thinking with silicon. Now,
I think that if we are under the right idea, then that would rival the theory of evolution in how it would affect our implications for our conception of human beings, and especially the mystery of thinking.
Well, Ken, frankly, I'm not all that sure that computers will ever really think. But I do know that our listeners are thinking.
What makes you so sure of that?
Well, they call us up all the time with their conundrums.
Stuck in a quandary? Why not give us a call? We won't solve your problems, but we'll make them a whole lot more complicated than you ever thought they could be. A little something we call a conundrum.
We have a listener named Chris. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Where are you calling from, Chris?
I'm calling from Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. That's one of those little states back east, right? It's kind of stuck in there between Connecticut and Maine somewhere?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Anyway, so what's your conundrum, Chris?
I have a terrible memory.
Oh, goodness.
And
so you don't remember your conundrum? Is that the problem?
terrible memory. I like to read, but within months, it's 90% gone. Does it make sense to keep reading, or should I just relax and watch TV?
Is your memory bad about everything, or just
it's bad about everything?
Oh, I see.
Oh, but books are the kind of thing where I feel like part of the pleasure is being able to say, "Oh yeah, Raskolnikov's friend was named such and such."
Right. Boy, I sympathize with you.
I'm trying to figure out what the philosophical question here is, John. Do you have a take on the philosophical question here?
I think the question you have to ask is, why are you reading? And it sounds like you're feeling bad because you have a certain vision of what reading should do for you. It should it should dump stuff into your memory banks that you'll be useful to you on later occasions. But really, that's not what novels are
for.
All about, right? Yeah. They're to enjoy.
Yeah, so, the reading of it. The experience of reading is the thing you should strive for.
So I would say, you know, it's kind of too bad that your memory keeps you from having these secondary benefits of reading, but keep in mind you're getting the primary benefits.
Yeah, look, let me say, let's make a philosophical distinction, sort of. You're approaching it reading in too utilitarian a way.
Uh-huh.
You're asking, what do I get out of reading? What are the consequences of my having read the novel? And you're weighing whether to read the novel by the sort of downside consequences. But you should think of it more as purely intrinsically aesthetic terms.
So I should feel like it's enough to read the novel and enjoy it as I read it.
Yeah.
You might do like I do and just mostly read trash because you don't. Then you don't feel
you
bad
don't
about not remembering.
It's junk food. It goes away. It's like simple carbohydrates. You eat it. It goes away.
Right.
Reading is kind of almost a religious thing in our culture. For example, if you're blind and you listen to a book on tape, that's fine. But if you aren't blind and you listen to a book on tape, people look at you like, what's wrong with him?
Yeah. Right.
Is reading just a way of getting information into the old pipeline? Then recordings ought to be just as good.
Right.
But we don't really think of that way. We think of reading as a positive pleasure. And if you have that, you've got the main thing.
Actually, I want to put in a word for books on tape. Having something read aloud, is a beautiful thing. Anyway, I hope we've helped you with your conundrum.
Yeah, well, I can't remember what you said, but I think I liked it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling Philosophy
Talk. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Philosophy Talk comes to you from a latitude of 37.4281654. And a longitude of -122.170.8145.
No, you mean Philosophy Corner at Stanford.
Well, yeah, everybody knows the longitude and latitude of Philosophy Corner at Stanford University, that pinnacle of the intellect that holds the rest of the university up.
Our program is produced by Ben Manillo Productions of San Francisco, copyrights 2002, Stanford University. Our team includes Peter Cremens, Jonathan Mitchell, Amy Standen, Alex Martinez, Merle Kessler, and Monica Hill. Production assistance from KQED Radio. I'm Ken Taylor.
I'm John Perry. And it was Rene Descartes who said, "I think, therefore I am." We hope you say, "I like to think, therefore I like Philosophy Talk."
I'd like to think I'd like Philosophy Talk.
Ken, is that the Stanford band? I hear drumming.
John, that's not drumming. That's conundrumming.
Oh.
To confound us with your conundrum, contact us at philosophytalk.org.
Our next caller did just that. Let's welcome Lisa.
Where are you calling from, Lisa?
I'm calling from San Carlos.
Where is that? In the San Francisco Bay Area?
It's in the Bay Area.
It's a little town somewhere between Millbrae and Palo Alto.
Right.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us your conundrum, Lisa?
I worked for 10 years at a university in the area. And at this institution was a very, very, very excellent daycare.
Uh-huh.
I have two children. One is 5 and one is 2.5. The 2.5-year-old made it partway through, and I left the university, so I lost my affiliation.
Yeah.
So my younger child can't go to this institute anymore. And I've been seeking alternative daycare for him, but I can't find anything that even comes close to the quality that I had.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm looking to re-enter the workforce at this same establishment, and I could lie and say I've already got a job and I could get my daycare back, and since I'm going to be getting a job there eventually, you figure, well, I'll catch up with it. But I know the people that work at this daycare, and some of them are friends of mine, and I respect them a lot, and I really like them, so I really don't want to lie to them.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, my child's daycare is extremely important to me.
I mean, you can think of this question in two ways, it seems to me. There's an age-old conflict between what people sometimes call prudence, or let's just call that self-interest, and there's morality or fairness or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you just think in a self-interested manner, without considerations of morality, you can ask the question, is it worth it? Is it in my self-interest to lie to these people for the benefit of myself?
So what are the risks of getting caught? How embarrassed would you be? Would you lose the possibility of getting the job you want?
Are you a good liar?
They don't check very carefully. All you have to do is fill out a form.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
But let's say that prudentially, that is in terms of your own self-interest and those of your family, your own extended self-interest, it looks like the answer is yeah. From a prudential point of view,
right. You
should do it. But now how about from a moral point of view?
That's different.
That's a good question. The philosopher Kant thought that rules like don't lie were just terribly important.
Yeah, he thought they were absolute.
But now what do you think about people that lie to you even because it's in their self-interest? I mean, do you get mad at them?
Well, can you give me an example? I mean, it would depend on the situation.
Well, suppose that you had fixed a lunch for your son at daycare and you drove to daycare to drop it off. And you gave it to a woman who had forgotten to fix a lunch for her son, but she didn't tell you that. Instead, she said, oh, I'll give it to your boy. So she lied to you, and then she gave the lunch to her boy, and her boy got a nice lunch, and yours didn't. So it was clearly in her and her boy's self-interest to lie to you, and she did lie to you. Now, would you be mad at her?
Yes, I would, but I see a difference.
What's the difference?
I'm not bringing harm to somebody else by lying.
Oh, wait a minute now. I thought you said this was the world's greatest daycare.
Aren't there people waiting
to get in?
Yes.
Aren't there people who have the status, the required status, who would be waiting?
Oh, yes, I guess so.
isn't that harm?
It wouldn't be much different than the woman who took the sandwich.
Yeah, but can I tell you something else that complicates it?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I know also for a fact that there are a couple of people there who are not affiliated, but they're friends of the people who are directing the program.
This is a moral swamp here.
Yes.
The institution apparently is not very vigilant in the enforcement of their own policies.
That's
their responsibility, not hers. So maybe she wouldn't be in the wrong. Maybe the institution's in the wrong, but there's no complaint against her.
And I think at a certain point that becomes the right way to look at it.
Yeah.
The place I work has little signs up in all the rooms, no food or drink. But nobody pays attention to them.
And
what's the point? I mean, why would I wouldn't feel the least bit guilty about violating that rule.
I think you shouldn't go out of your way to deceive them. Right? If they choose not to verify your offered employment history, they're failing. I think they're morally failing.
I think if Kant is listening, he may write you a letter, Ken.
Yes,
and say,
I know.
Get
He's
off
such
my
an
bandwagon.
Absolutist. He's such an absolutist. Well, I hope we've given you at least some means of thinking in philosophical ways about your conundrum, Lisa.
Yeah. Bring up a few things I hadn't thought of.
Okay. It was nice talking to you,
okay,
Lisa.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk.
Drop by our website and leave us your conundrum at www.philosophytalk.org.
Our topic for today is thinking machines. Can computers think? John McCarthy says yes. John Searle says no. We've listened to a lively debate between them.
In this segment, we're going to focus more on the question, what if they could think? What would the implications of that be?
This is the stuff that movies have been made of. Stanley Kubrick's 2001, Blade Runner, and probably dozens of others.
Steven Spielberg's AI.
Yeah, lots of times the computers don't think they're being treated quite fairly.
We're going to talk about Blade Runner a little later, but the idea of thinking machines goes well back before science fiction movies.
Here's a report from Peter Crimmins that shows that our fascination with this idea dates back several centuries.
Drop a quarter into the slot. Now the wooden grandmother in the cabinet looks warily at you, turns her head in pondering your fate, and delivers her prophecy on a little card. Grandmother tells me, You are a very sensitive person and a very critical one. You have a very sharp tongue, which may cause unhappiness to others. How could she know that?
It's just a mechanical vending machine. You know, that's all.
Breaking my suspension of disbelief is Dan Zielinski, the guy who maintains the upkeep of antique arcade machines at the Musée Mécanique, overlooking San Francisco's Ocean Beach.
Mechanical musical instruments and fortune tellers and strength testers and love tellers, things like photo booths, you know, things like that.
These machines, some of which are well over 100 years old, can get quite complicated. The Engelhardt Orchestrion packs a complete orchestra inside its cabinet, performing all the instruments for a full rendition of old-time classics. With its inner workings behind glass, you can see the brain behind the one-man band. But it's not a brain.
You see the perforations on that piano roll there?
Yeah, I see
that. Each perforation turns something on and off. It goes over that brass tracker bar. There's 80 different...
While Dan describes the hypnotic inner workings of the orchestrion, the music seems more canned and soulless. What might have been a machine intelligently creating music is rendered a feat of basic mechanical engineering. Part of the machine's entertainment comes from watching the music.
I want people to see how things work, because that's what's most interesting. It's not just the performance of what it can do, but how it's doing it is what's fascinating, especially by today's standards where everything is computerized. You can open a computer and you won't see how it works. You open up anything here and the naked eye can see exactly how it works, whether you know what you're looking at or not. You can see it working. And that is a fascinating element of mechanics.
Today, they might be called quaint, but 300 years ago, machines like the orchestrion were the pinnacles of technical achievement. In the 1700s, ambitious and inventive clockmakers sought to make machines that could mimic human characteristics. Called automata, they were mechanical ornaments for the very rich that could set the table, play music, even act like a duck. Jacques Valkenson, for example, created a sensational automaton in 1737 that could play a flute by breathing and fingering the holes of the instrument. Author Tom Standage writes about historical technology.
Valkenson's automata, his flute player, was regarded as so amazing by some people that they thought it had to be a trick. And so he actually had to open up the inside so that the scientists of Paris could have a look inside and verify that, yes, this was indeed a genuine automaton. So even at that stage, which is the 1730s, automata are already more complicated than most people are capable of understanding. And once you're in that position, people's ability to judge what is and is not possible with a machine is problematic.
Standage is the author of The Turk, The Life and Times of the Famous 18th Century Chess-Playing Machine. The Turk was, like Valkenson's flute player, an automaton. Created by Austrian Wolfgang von Kempelen in 1770, the Turk reigned as the supreme automaton for 100 years. It played chess.
If you talk today about somebody being a mindless automaton, you mean they're doing the same thing over and over again without changing. And of course, that's what most automata did. And the amazing thing about the chess player was that it was interactive. It responded to its opponent's moves. So I think the reason that Kempelen built it was that there were all these automata that imitated different aspects of human nature. And he thought, well, what's the ultimate human quality? It's the ability to think. And so an automaton that appeared to be able to think would just, you know, would just knock everyone's socks off. It would be the best possible automaton.
A mechanical object that could think? And think so well as to best the best chess players of the age? The Turk had its believers and its skeptics, but even the skeptics were fans. And as it turns out, the Turk was, in fact, a hoax. Nobody was able to definitively prove it until much later, but there was indeed a clever person crouched inside the Turk's cabinet, hidden behind some authentic-looking machinery. So now let's jump ahead a couple hundred years. In the 1950s, Alan Turing developed his famous test to suss out artificial intelligence from the real McCoy. In 1996, IBM developed Deep Blue, a computer that could supposedly think. Both of these relied on chess as a contest to prove intelligence.
The best yardstick for intelligence is all about trickery and playing games and imitating humans. And that's exactly what the Turk was. Back in 1769, it was a trick and imitated a human and played a game. And so the hilarious thing is that having had 200 years to think about this, we're right back where we started. And this is I think, Kempelen's great achievement, whether deliberately or not. He accidentally stumbled on what the computer scientists of the 20th century would later conclude on their own.
Even though many observers strongly suspected the Turk was a fraud, it did not lessen the automaton's popularity. It may have even increased ticket sales. The Turk, like the fortune tellers and canned orchestras of the Musée Mécanique, don't threaten to rival human intelligence, but they do try. Therein might be the appeal, to see one of our machines mimic ourselves. And as scientists continue to mold doppelgangers out of nuts and bolts and motherboards, we're forced to think about what is, essentially, human. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Peter Crimmins.
So people have been dreaming for a long time about machines that are more intelligent than humans.
That's right.
I mean, I can think of a few radio hosts that probably couldn't pass the Turing test.
Care to name any names?
I don't think I should. But if we put aside our skepticism about whether computers will really think and just ask, what if they did? What would human life be like? Would it be better or worse than it is to have all these thinking machines around?
When we get to household robots, we want to create them in such a way that children do not regard them as persons.
John McCarthy rejoins us in a moment. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything,
even your artificial intelligence.
I'm John McCarthy from Stanford University, and this is Philosophy Talk.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry.
Our question this week, can machines think? Will computers someday be conscious, outstrip human intelligence? Or will they make our moral universe vastly more murky?
John McCarthy, who coined the phrase artificial intelligence, is a professor of computer science right here at Stanford.
Perhaps you can start out by telling us something about the current state of artificial intelligence. How close are we to having thinking computers?
Well, we've had thinking computers for a long time. It's just they don't think very well, and they think partly. So what you really are asking is how far off are we from human-level artificial intelligence?
I suppose that is what I'm asking you, yes.
Okay, and now I give the answer usually, and this is the answer I've given for the last 30 years. It may be 5 years, and it may be 500 years, because, in my opinion, some new big ideas are needed, and maybe some graduate student has had them and has said, you know, all these professors have got it wrong, here's the way to do it, and he'll be the Einstein of the field.
So for 30 years, has the field been stagnating if you've been giving that same answer for 30 years?
No, it's been making steady progress along a number of different fronts. One front is the imitation of the human brain as made of nerve cells and so forth. But they aren't up to human level yet. Another one is the logical approach, which is the one I follow. It involves the computer having in its memory facts about the world expressed in languages of mathematical logic and deciding what to do by logical reasoning supplemented by straightforward computation.
You talk about the logical work, and we're talking about human intelligence, but there's all sorts of other capacities, cognitive and emotional capacities that human beings have that, you know, many people would say have nothing to do with logic, the capacity for, you know, love, empathy, the capacity to just understand another person and put yourself in another person's position, or just the fundamental thing, consciousness. Is there any reason to believe that the logical approach has any power to illuminate the full range of human cognitive and emotive and capacities?
Well, at least a large number of them represents these states logically. That is, Mary loves George can be represented in Mary's mind by some collection of logical sentences.
I'm not quite sure I'm following you. I mean, love is, I don't know what love is, a feeling or emotion or something. It's not a, is it a logical?
What's love got to do with it? That's what I'm
Well, I'm just wondering if we can get the full panoply of human cognitive capacities and emotive capacities out of computers.
Not to mention the full panoply of.
Yeah, that's right. The full plate. I mean, what about, say, creativity? Could you get a computer to be creative? That seems kind of hyper-logical or ultra, or beyond logical.
My computer beats me at chess a new way, every time I play it. Isn't that creativity?
Okay. Well, I wrote a paper about creativity for computers. And what I said in this paper is that I didn't understand how to make the computer creative, but I wanted to distinguish a creative solution from a routine solution of the problem, where the creative solution involves some elements that are not present in the language in which the problem is stated. And so we're making a little progress in understanding creativity there.
Another question. I mean, human beings are in some ways, you know, they do all sorts of amazing things, but they also have all kinds of limits. There's a limit to human intelligence, perhaps, a limit to human creativity. You think computers will someday exceed the limits of human cognitive capacities?
Yes, they will, because if they can achieve human cognitive capacity, then they can do better just by making them run faster.
Yeah.
So if we create computers with the capacities of consciousness, thought, action, sensation, and freedom, will we have created something that has rights just as we do? Will we have created something that needs to vote? Will we have created something it should be wrong to unplug?
I think we want to avoid that. And I think that the level of intelligence is not involved there. One can have something that's arbitrarily intelligent and still has no purposes of its own. It has no capacity, for example, for suffering. And they should be created in such a way that human beings are not inclined either to love them or hate them. And in particular, when we get to household robots, we want to create them in such a way that children do not regard them as persons.
Well, so it sounds to me like there's two kind of nightmare scenarios here in the future if the potential for artificial intelligence is as unbounded as you suggest. Here's one nightmare scenario, which you just said we should avoid, is that there is actually a race of superior creatures, right? Intellectually superior, cognitively superior. They have purposes of their own, they're conscious, and they might look at us and think, you guys aren't so special. Why should you be running the show? That's one scenario. There's another scenario that could be regarded as a nightmare. I don't know, at least a moral nightmare. We have a race of slaves, a race of creatures with intelligence and consciousness and maybe purpose, but a diminished forms of that, and we use them as mere tools. If we were to do that to human beings, if we were to use genetic engineering to give rise to a creature, a set of degraded human beings, but still recognizably human beings, but degraded, that would be morally bad. So are you saying that there should be a line which we should not allow science to cross, the science of artificial intelligence? Because if it crosses that line, it gets us into deep moral turpitude or deep moral doo-doo.
Well, first of all, we need to distinguish between science and engineering. And science is concerned with understanding. And I see no limits on what we can want to understand. Now, with regard to what we actually build, yes, we can impose limits on what we actually build. However, the issue is not here yet. I remember that in 1970, a meeting was organized on what should we do about the imminent human-level artificial intelligence. And the organizers thought that the world politicians and the U.S. and the Soviet Union should ponder this question. And I succeeded in sabotaging the meeting so that it did not come out with any recommendations whatsoever. Because just imagine what would have happened in the last election campaign if somebody had said, had demanded from Bush and Gore, what is your position on artificial intelligence? And if they were smart, they would ignore it. If they were not quite so smart, it would go to the third assistant speechwriter who would put in a sentence about it And then who knows it? What some dumb thing that the third assistant speechwriter thought of might become the policy of the United States government.
Let's end this segment by emphasizing that John McCarthy's not the Lone Ranger here. There's lots of people who think that artificial intelligence is about to make both a practical and really a spiritual or philosophical difference in our lives.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Bill Joy, for example, predicted that robots are about to become the dominant life form on Earth.
And then there's this fellow, Ray Kurzweil, who's a leader in voice recognition. And he talks about the emergence in the 21st century of a new form of intelligence on Earth that can compete with and ultimately significantly exceed human intelligence.
Yeah, of course, for every gung-ho advocate, there's also a skeptic out there.
You can find out more about these artificial intelligence enthusiasts on our website,
philosophytalk.org.
Artificial intelligence is one of Hollywood's favorite topics, Ken.
And one of my all-time favorite movies, Blade Runner, deals with this specifically.
Well, then don't beat around a bush. Get out of the way and let's have Philosophy Talk Goes to the Movies.
How can it not know what it is?
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto.
Harrison Ford is a Blade Runner. A Blade Runner is a cop who hunts down and kills replicants. The replicants are a race of android slaves. They fight, they labor in mines, they're sexual tools, all sorts of stuff. And they've started to revolt. They don't like it. Because the problem with replicants, although they have all these neat capacities, they're conscious, they're rational, they're strong, they're agile, they only have a 4-year lifespan. And they really fear death.
What seems to be the problem?
Death.
Death.
Well, I'm afraid that's a little out of my jurisdiction.
I want more life.
You were made as well as we could make you, but not to last.
Okay, now, this sounds like a great movie, and I remember it's very exciting and very dark.
Yes, very dark.
Presents Los Angeles as a rather dismal place in 2019. Yeah. What's philosophically interesting about it?
Well, Harrison Ford hunts down and kills, in cold blood, without any remorse at first, it seems, what seem like sentient, intelligent, conscious creatures. I mean, they look like they should be part of our moral community.
So is the problem that the engineers made them too much like us?
Well, in some ways, too much and not enough. See, the technology in the movie is deep. It's a very technologically advanced society. They have all these hovercrafts. They have all these fancy computers that can do fancy things. But the whole movie has this sort of forbidding, depressive, dark. It's like a futuristic film noir. So the technology feels like it's like pressing down on you in some sense, even though it's enabled all sorts of things. And I think the highest technological achievement are the androids themselves. And they just add to the moral quandary. They make the moral universe more murky, more dark.
Is technology a good thing? They've created a world in which their own moral sense isn't adequate to cope with the dilemmas they've raised.
Yeah.
We seem to be doing that with cloning suppose the National Science Foundation put out a call for proposals that said, we'd like somebody to use technology to create a situation in which all of our moral intuitions and institutions are challenged by questions and burdens that they can't possibly live up to and respond to.
Yeah.
That would be kind of stupid.
Yeah.
But isn't that really
where we're
what
going.
Happened to them, and isn't it where we're going?
That's a question. You're right. That is what the world that Blade Runner presents to us is a world in which there's all this technological power that's a result of science advancing and all that sort of stuff, and then moral quandaries that just outstrip our ability to solve them. And Harrison Ford is a representative of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he kills some cold-bloodedly, he's saved by one, and he loves one. I mean, so what's the attitude? Are these instruments? Are these fellow beings? You know, we don't know the answer. The movie doesn't answer it for us.
We're no computers, Sebastian. We're physical.
I think, Sebastian. Therefore, I am.
So, Ken, we're left with some big questions about thinking, computers, and the future of artificial intelligence. There's the philosophical questions, will computers be able to think? And then there's the kind of more social questions. I mean, what would life be like with a bunch of intelligent computers around, like Blade Runner portrays it? Or yeah. is there some brighter future out
yeah,
there for
you
us?
You know, technology is forcing us into kind of a new world, you know, a new and promising a revolution in our understanding of the natural world.
I suppose you're getting back to your analogy between the theory of thought as computation and the theory of evolution.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly. Before Darwin and Wallace, you know, there was simply no good theory, none, of how we came by this complex natural world with all of these different species interacting and interlocking. There was just no good theory.
Well, there was the idea that God designed it all. It's right there in Genesis.
Yeah, but that wasn't really a theory at all in the sense that, you know, it didn't provide hypotheses that guide scientific research. Evolution has done that. It's the whole basis of modern biology, a vast and really exciting domain of science.
Well, the theory of evolution certainly precipitated great changes in the way humans look at themselves. It's not been exactly a fun story.
Yeah, it's not been completely uplifting.
You know, we're just a little twig on the big tree of evolution. Our wonderful brain is no more startling than the
right.
elephant's big nose.
Yeah, you know, and I think that AI has the potential to put the sort of last dig at theistic arguments. I mean, don't get me wrong. People have lots of reasons for being religious. But the mystery of thinking won't be one of them if John McCarthy and his fellow visionaries are right. The mind will have been completely demystified.
Well, I see what you're getting at. Descartes thought the mind had to be immaterial for, among other reasons, to explain thinking.
Yeah,
he thought thinking dealt with the infinite and material couldn't deal with the infinite.
Right.
Once minds are immaterial, they're not very far from the souls of religion. And Descartes made the connection.
Right.
So if all that goes, then
the mind is no more material than these silicon chips. Here.
Yeah, still, I tell you the truth, I think religious beliefs will be around longer than artificial intelligence. They
Maybe
may lose an argument, but they won't lose the war.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
There's another question. You think we'll be reducing ourselves to machines. Do you think that it'll turn out we're just symbol manipulators? But maybe it'll turn out that symbol manipulators really have souls.
Oh, maybe.
That's kind of the question that Blade Runner poses, I guess.
I think, Sebastian. Therefore, I am.
This has been Philosophy Talk.
Our program is produced by Ben Manila Productions of San Francisco. Copyright 2002, Stanford University.
Our team includes Peter Crimmins, Merle Kessler, Jonathan Mitchell, Amy Standen, Alex Martinez, and Monica Hill.
With production assistance from KQED Radio. I'm Ken Taylor, and he's John Perry.
Wittgenstein said, "Whereof one cannot speak, thereon one must be silent." So thereon I will be silent.
You promise?